Chapter 2. Falling Skies. Castor. By late afternoon, the Aquila was flying once again above the Basilica of St. Albarac the Smelter. The echoing, decrepit ecclesiarchy headquarters had been the primary objective of the northernmost imperial salient assault. According to the after-action reports being logged on Castor's display, it had fallen almost without a fight, largely abandoned by the greenskins as they had flocked to engage the Fulminata's drive to the Gorgon. Now it was the headquarters of the combined Imperial Command in Shebat Alpha. Castor watched as a harried-looking ministerium deacon hurried from pillar to pillar, applying tinctures of blessed oil and muttering the canticles of purification. Orderly staff officers began flooding the nave and apse, setting up the paraphernalia of military command. A humming power generator was inserted into the ambulatory, fussed over by red-cowled tech adepts. Thick clusters of cabling led to a hollow chart assembled in the chancel, beneath the remains of the altar. More lines were tacked to the narrow stone casements leading to the basilica's belfry, where the headquarters communication hub had been established, hard-wired in case signals became blocked or scrambled. Physical charts, troop rosters, and orders of battle were pinned up to the bullet-scarred walls of the apse, and the whole echoing space was soon illuminated by jury-rigged lumen strips that buzzed with electrical charge. A flakboard sentry post was being constructed outside, and sandbags and ablative shielding heaped around the broken windows and entrances. Castor lent his own prayers to the work of the ecclesiarchy, seeking to reconsecrate the old stonework around him. As night fell, Field Marshal Kloss arrived with his senior staff and a detail of Tempestus scions who took up security rotations around the former place of worship. Captain Demeter was present as well, a giant in his blue gravis armor, dwarfing the humans scurrying about his feet. An extensive debrief of the day's engagements began, along with final planning and preparation for the next day's push. Castor and Polixis removed themselves early and passed together down into the vaults. The space was being converted into a reserve armory bunker, stocked with crates of supplies to be used should shelling force the headquarters staff underground. The Primaris had passed through the echoing dank spaces to a familial offshoot, a branch of alcoves owned, according to the crumbling lettering, by the great Shebat industrialist family, the Fazals. There, on one of the tomb slabs not yet occupied, they laid out the body of Brother Ovido. Castor lit the stone alcove with the wan light of a trio of electro candles. He watched in silence while Polixis worked. Tech Marine Tiberon had already removed the Intercessor's blessed Mark X power armor and armaments for repair and reuse. Polixis now harvested his body. Those organs that could still be implanted into future generations of the Ultramarines chapter were extracted one by one, before being placed carefully in white cryo units stamped with the helix sigil of the Apothecarian.
Spirit of the Emperor's righteous servant, accept your removal from the flesh of your warring vessel, Polixis murmured. Stay true, that you may imbue the future of the chapter with vengeful purpose.
Castor listened as Polixis continued to recite the rites of recovery, his brother's gauntlets and Narthesium red with Ovido's blood. The crumbling old tomb space filled with the soft rending of flesh and the surgical buzz of chainblade and drill bit. The final organs were removed, joining the precious, lone progenoid that had already been sealed into the main cryo unit. Ovido lay like a demonstration piece for space marine physiology, his rib plate split open, remaining organs exposed to the cold, dank air. Polixis set to work sewing the sliced flesh back together, working with a speed and precision that none but the most experienced human surgeons or mortuary attendants could have matched. Eventually, with Ovido's remains bound by rows of neat black stitching, he nodded wordlessly to Castor. The chaplain, his skull helm even more sinister in the flickering candlelight, took a step forwards to stand over the slab and the body that lay atop it.
Blessed Emperor of Man, Saviour of our race, look down upon us now as we recall the deeds of a brother fallen in your service.
The words sounded through the old crypt, as dark as the shadows that stretched and yawned around the Space Marines. Polixis bowed his head while Castor intoned the chapter's funerary rites, commending the soul of Ovido to the Emperor and to the honored forebears who had fought for mankind's preeminence for over 10,000 years.
He held the breach at Qatar, alongside Scaevola and Tullio, for 8 Terran hours, until reinforcement could be made, the chaplain said, listening to the Fallen's greatest achievements. At Lorenzis, he destroyed 12 heretical war engines single-handedly. Against the cult of the Fivefold, he was grievously wounded, while ensuring the safety of Brother Ronus. Who else among the assembled recalls his deeds?
I remember him at Patricia's Lawn, Polixis responded. I remember him at the Cab Pass. He helped me to stabilize Brother Tars from then-Squad Drusus. Tars would have fallen that day without him. Now he is an honored sergeant in the 2nd Company. That is just one of Ovido's many legacies.
Ovido's brethren from Squad Nerva should have been present to recount their personal memories of the Fallen. Such a thing was not possible, with the Intercessor Squad holding the east bank of the Gorgon through the hours of darkness, and in truth, to receive a full remembrance while the company was still combat effective was rare. The Codex Astartes called for honor and reverence, but also practicality as far as the dead were concerned. Ovido had been a Mars-born Primaris, like many still among the Fulminata, so his body would have no resting place within the realm of Ultramar. Once back on board the Spear of Macragge, it would be cremated, and its ashes fired into the void, a last tribute in an uncaring and brutal galaxy. Castor closed the small ceremony with the final rites, making the sign of the Aquila over the pale corpse. Afterwards, the 2 Primaris stood in silence for a while, the only noise the distant scrape and thud of more supplies being hauled down to the adjacent crypts by guard orderlies.
Priscor lives? Castor asked eventually.
Yes. He's been shuttled to the Spear of Macragge. Artima is tending to him until I can relocate. She reports that he is in a stable condition.
The compiece in Castor's ear blurted, a sudden jagged spike of static overlaying a few incoherent words. After a few seconds, it returned to silence. The signal in the crypts was almost non-existent.
Squad Nerva will want vengeance, Castor went on. I must be careful to channel their hatred towards its proper end.
That is your prerogative, Polixis said.
I sense there is more you wish to say, Castor continued after Polixis went no further. Speak your mind, my brother. You have seemed reticent these past few days. Our brothers may not notice, Polixis, but we came from the same womb. You cannot hide this from me.
Every squad, bar the Reavers, has now suffered at least 1 fatal casualty since making planetfall. Polixis said, looking from Ovido's body to his blood brother, the chaplain. The Xenos have been driven back on all fronts, but they still control vast swathes of Ikara. Even this city is only halfway to being cleansed. At the current rate, our casualties are only just sustainable.
I am sure Captain Demeter is aware of that, Castor said.
But it would be remiss of me not to mention it. Polixis said. You are the guardian of this company's spirit, my brother, but I am responsible for their bodies. It is my duty.
You wish for me to mention it to the captain, Castor surmised.
He will be expecting me to take issue with our losses. That is part of my role, after all. Hearing it from you will carry a greater weight.
More static chopped in over the vox. Both Primaris ignored it. Castor went on.
You know him as well as I, brother. He does not take the death of a single ultramarine lightly. Our mode of warfare on this world is dictated by circumstance. We have no intelligence pertaining to the Xenos warlord leading the aliens here, and without the ability to land a single precise blow, Our place is bolstering the guard. You saw what we achieved out there today. How many weeks would be required, and how many thousands more would have fallen had the humans been forced to fight their way to that river, street by street, without us?
We are bred for war, and losses are inevitable, Polixis said, the words sounding tired and heavy. I long ago accepted that. But if we cannot find a means to shorten this conflict, few of us will leave this world.
I will speak with the captain, Castor repeated. As should you. I am certain the matter is already on his mind.
There was yet another jagged spurt of static over the Vox. A cold feeling settled over Castor, a foreboding instinct born of more than a century of combat. He could tell from the slight shift in his brother's stance that he had felt it too.
Something's wrong, the apothecary said.
Without another word, the two Primaris strode from the alcove, Polixis motioning to the four chapter serfs in their blue shifts waiting outside to enter and seal Avedo's remains in the black plastic body bag they carried between them. They made for the stone stairs leading back up to the basilica, supply orderlies in the uniform of the Departamento Munitorum hurrying to get out of their way. It was only when they emerged into the ambulatory behind the basilica's apse that the Vox signal cleared and the full weight of what was unfolding became apparent. The sudden surge in Vox traffic was originating from high orbit. From the snatches of ongoing conversation that the Space Marines' Vox beads were picking up, it sounded as though there was a full-scale stand-to among the Imperial Navy fleet anchored above Ikara 9. They rounded the ambulatory and entered the chancel, where the holo chart had been set up. Bodies crowded around it, sweat-streaked and pale in the unforgiving brightness of the makeshift lumen arrays. There were Guard Corps commanders in the field dress of their respective regiments, signals officers, the Munitorum Quartermaster Primary, and the commander of the local Ikaran elements, all chattering nervously, while two Adeptus Mechanicus adepts bent over the chart's regulator relay. Castor noted the presence of Field Marshal Stefan Kloss, son of Lord General Helgar Kloss, one of the heroes of Cadia, a decorated Astra Militarum commander whose face bore as many jagged scars as Demeter's. The captain was also among them. He had cleaned and anointed his Gravis armor in the hours immediately following the day's engagement, and now he towered over the officers and staff aides, gleaming and untouchable. His helm was maglocked to his hip, and his viciously scarred features were stern and silent, thrown into strange contrasts by the lights from the lumens above and the glow of the chart below. The humans nearest him hurried to make way as Castor and Polixis joined him on either side.
"Brethren," he said, "Brother Ovido has received the final rites." "He has, brother captain," Castor said.
Both the chaplain and the apothecary had removed their helmets as they approached the chart, conscious of Demeter's orders that they present their faces as often as possible around their human allies. Being seen as anything other than unyielding automata was not something that concerned most Adeptus Astartes, but like many of Gilliman's favoured, the captain of the Fulminata seemed to be as much a diplomat as he was a soldier. According to Demeter, showing the human soldiers and citizens of the Imperium that they were flesh and blood had a multitude of morale benefits. Polixis understood the reasoning, though he knew that Castor considered it a foolish affectation. The chaplain respected Demeter enough, however, to adhere to the ruling in his presence. Without their helms, Castor knew he and the apothecary's shared lineage was laid bare. Both had the same firm jawline, accentuated by the natural bulk and solid bone structure of all Primaris, though Castor bore the scars of a Tyranid's claws that marked him out from his brother. Both had the same hair, as golden as a full Iaxian harvest, though Polixis wore his cropped closer to the scalp. Most clearly of all, both had the same pale grey eyes, wintry and discerning. In the face of a human being, they might have been described as thoughtful, even sad. There was no denying that, even accounting for the transitional similarities common to the genetics shared by all Ultramarines, Castor and Polixis had been brothers before the beginning of their first initiation rites.
"There is a situation, Captain,"
Castor asked, as both Primaris surveyed the holochart. It had been beaming a sea-green projection of Shebat and its surrounds, the great polluted sweep of the Gorgon and the arid peaks of the Tombstone Mountains that lay immediately to the west and south. Parts of that map were dissolving now and being replaced with a star chart showing the Icarus system, its constituent planets and moons, and the positions of Imperial fleet elements. Sections of the display continued to blink and update as auger and sensorium data filtered through, overseen by the two tech adepts laboring to keep the hololithic chart connected.
"Situation is an understatement," said Field Marshal Kloss, speaking for the first time.
He smacked one palm into the holochart's glassy surface, causing the entire three-dimensional display to flicker.
"They've caught us cold, Throne, damn them! How many times have I told High Command not to underestimate these beasts?"
"A Xenos fleet has just completed a warp jump into Icaran real space," Demeter explained to Castor and Polixis. "Dangerously close to the system core."
"How close?"
Castor asked, eyes on the chart. Green skull runes, no doubt representing Orc capital ships, were starting to appear amidst the stellar cartography.
"You heard the Ultramarine,"
Kloss snapped at a bald, corpulent Navy attaché in the starched green dress uniform of the Segmentum battle fleet.
"How close?"
The man jumped, all but cringing beneath the sudden, intense scrutiny. His eyes darted over the chart readings.
I think perhaps 4 hours, my lord, if they maintain their initial heading and speed."
"Perhaps,"
Kloss snarled, smacking the chart again.
"Perhaps just about sums this all up. Throne, damn it all, Morrelin!"
He snapped his fingers at a white-uniformed man with the heavy aural augmetics of a guard vox chief.
"Have you got Lord Commander von Klimt on the line yet?"
No, sir,
Morrelin said, one hand going up to the device sutured into the side of his skull as he filtered the communications traffic reaching the headquarters.
"His aide claims he's still in an emergency holo-conference with Rear Admiral Corran."
Demeter had said nothing since Kloss's arrival, but as the Field Marshal opened his mouth to utter another string of invectives, the Space Marine raised his right gauntlet. The motion was slight, yet it caused even the Graf Cadian to pause.
"Captain Spaulding," the Ultramarine said levelly, "can you offer us a professional opinion on the size of the enemy fleet that has just entered real space?"
"Their numbers are still updating,"
the Navy officer replied hesitantly.
"But the system's auger station and the fleet's sensorium arrays have confirmed at least 5 capital ships, with between 3 and 5 more currently being assessed. Escort numbers remain unverified, but it is undoubtedly a major incursion. The subsector battle fleet elements anchored in high orbit are probably outnumbered a little over 2 to 1.
"It can only be the fleet of Warlord Ur-Gork himself, then,"
Demeter said.
"He has brought the forefront of the war to this system."
"As I feared," Kloss said. "I warned von Klimt about this. 2 weeks ago, the Greenskin offensive in the Arden system stalls. 2 weeks ago, we retake Priscilla and secure the Ior salient. Why? Because they've shifted their center of power. They've moved their focus, their strength of mass, to here, to this system. 2 weeks is a short warp jump from Arden. 2 weeks, and they redeploy their primary elements here and crush us, turning the flank on the whole subsector defense. Sometimes I think those damned Xenos could teach our High Command a thing or two."
Castor growled, a gauntlet on the haft of his mag-locked Crozius.
"Careful, Field Marshal."
To his credit, even Kloss appeared to immediately regret his words, blanching at the black-armored Space Marine's ire.
"If Ur-Gork's fleet is approaching, our own in-system elements will be overwhelmed,"
Demeter went on. From anyone else around the chart, it would have sounded like defeatism. From the Primaris, it came across merely as carefully considered fact. He continued.
"An evacuation would also be impossible before they reach orbit.
So we engage the bastards, Kloss said, recovering his brashness. At the very least, we can give the neighboring systems time to readjust, maybe even dispatch reinforcements. We can sell our lives dearly here.
I suspect that will be our fate, Field Marshal, Demeter agreed. But it is pointless to sacrifice that which can be saved. I recommend the subsector battlefleet conducts a fighting retreat to the edge of the system, to either hold there for reinforcements or complete a warp jump withdrawal.
You want to yield orbit to the Xenos? Kloss said incredulously. That would give them immediate planet-wide air superiority. They'd fill the skies with their scrap bombers and launch orbital strikes with impunity.
That is the situation we will find ourselves in when our own fleet elements are destroyed, Demeter pointed out. How long do you believe Rear Admiral Corrin can hold out for? A Terran day, at the most? The sacrifice of significant elements of the Imperial Navy would provide us with almost no tangible advantage. Kloss said nothing, eyes fixed on the holochart, as he digested the Ultramarine's words. Demeter continued. I will be transmitting instructions for a fighting withdrawal to my own flagship within the next 30 minutes. The shipmaster will recommend the same course of action to the Rear Admiral.
I doubt Von Klimt will suggest anything similar to Corrin, Kloss said. The fool will probably want him to attack head-on.
Then he will find himself without the support of the Spear of Macragge, Demeter replied.
Lords, said Spalding tentatively, gesturing at the holochart.
A new sigil had blinked into life on the display, an orc glyph, larger than the others clustered around it.
What is it? Ur-Gork's flagship?
Kloss demanded, peering at the data readouts accompanying the marker designate.
No, said Spalding. It's worse. Much worse.
Xerxes. Shipmaster Xerxes broke the voxlink and sat back in his command throne. Beneath him, the bridge of the Spear of Macragge lay in silence, the faces of 100 deck officers turned up towards him in expectation. The Spartan work surfaces, cogitator banks, and vox relays gleamed in the light cast by the lumen strips and picked screen stands. Even the servitors ranking the gantries that ringed the command dais had gone into standby, awaiting the fresh bursts of coding cant that would give them purpose. Xerxes gestured towards the auger banks and spoke.
Diagnosticator, bring me the latest sensorium readout from Quadrant 9, Sector 13. Remove all incomplete variables prior to transference.
The order was not the one the bridge serfs had expected. The Spear of Macragge's auger staff hurried to obey, filtering the data and transmitting it directly to the shipmaster. Xerxes swiped and enhanced the slates built into the arms of his command throne, his gen-hanced mind analyzing it all in just a few heartbeats. The auger returns didn't lie. Xerxes saw his fears confirmed in the first grainy picked scans of the target area. There was a behemoth at the heart of the orc fleet that had just torn itself from the warp and was now approaching the system's core at full steam ahead, plasma drives blazing. Going by the designates Imperial Strategos attempted, often in vain, to apply to the ramshackle alien void vessels, it was a battleship, longer and bulkier than even an Emperor-class capital vessel of the Imperial Navy. That was not what gave Xerxes pause, however. It was the thing attached to the orc craft.
Heavy customization, he murmured to himself. Extra armor bulk and engine housing. It's a transport.
He trailed off. The scans showed that it was coupled to what appeared to be a large sphere of void-borne rock, a meteorite of fused and scarred stone. Its craggy surface was studded with more orc structures and plasma drives of its own, which blazed in sympathy with those of its carrier. A great skull glyph in its underside seemed to glare at Xerxes through the grainy images he swiped through, full of alien malice.
A rock, Xerxes said.
It was a method of planetary invasion so crude and so mindlessly brutal that only the Greenskins could possibly have conceived of it. An asteroid or meteorite would be seized by an Orc fleet and mined, installed with plasma drives that would enable the aliens to steer it to their own course. Thus directed, it would be flung at a target world, crash-landing with enough force to annihilate any planetary defences. Those Greenskins within that survived the impact would then disgorge and slaughter the stunned defenders. The rock's only weakness was the fact that they rarely, if ever, were capable of warp travel. They could be detected far out on the fringes of a system, engaged and neutralised. They possessed no warp drives. This one, however, did. The battleship had acted as its carrier. It would deliver it directly to Ikara. Of that, Xerxes had no doubt. The soft voice of the Spear of Macragge signals officer disturbed Xerxes's thoughts. Rear Admiral Corrin is awaiting a connection, Lord. Put him on the throne box, Xerxes ordered, activating his personal earpiece. The static, chopped voice of the Navy Admiral crackled in his ear.
"Word from downstairs, shipmaster," he said. "Lord Commander von Klimt has given my fleet discretion to engage or withdraw as I see fit. My company commander has ordered me to mount a fighting retreat to the system's edge," Xerxes replied. "If we attempt to hold this anchorage, we will likely be surrounded and destroyed in detail."
"Agreed," Corrin said.
"I sense a degree of reluctance, Rear Admiral," Xerxes said.
"Leaving one of the God Emperor's worlds undefended before a ramshackle conglomerate of Xenos scum doesn't sit well," Corrin admitted.
"I agree. Perhaps a compromise. From their current speed, I don't believe the main body of the Xenos fleet will be able to overtake us. We should be able to engage their vanguard and still withdraw without becoming committed to a full fleet action. And while we're at it, perhaps we might attempt to strike a blow at that monstrous payload they have bound for Ikara."
"Agreed," Corrin said. "If you wish to take the lead, the Pride of Makaroth and Lance of Vengeance will support you."
"We have been given discretion to conduct a fighting withdrawal," Xerxes said. "So let's fight, Rear Admiral."
"Good hunting, Ultramarine."
The connection ended. Xerxes looked out across the bridge once more, taking in the expectant silence before issuing the order.
"All hands, clear for action."
Urgork. Morcopolips was ready. Urgork bashed his skin-in blades together, the huge, wickedly serrated weapons clanging out over the bridge of the Worldhammer. Slyboy, the Orc warboss's blind seer, cringed back from his master's exuberance.
"Here we go, Sly, ya git!" Urgork bellowed, grinning from tusk to tusk.
He thumped one of his great blades into the decomposing squig corpse sagging beside his trophy-laden chair, and snatched the Orc Psyker by the throat with his now free hand, hauling the runty greenskin close.
You better have got this one right,"
he snarled, gristle-flecked spit splattering the weird boy. The smaller Orc squirmed and choked, nodding vigorously in the warlord's grasp.
"Tell me!"
Urgork trailed off into incoherent stammers, tusks grinding together. His body seemed to freeze up, a twitch tugging at his scarred face, one eye rolling back into its socket while the other dilated. Slyboy's legs beat the air in panic as the warboss's grip continued to tighten, slowly choking him.
"Grok!"
Urgork managed to growl from between his locked jaws, foam building around his maw. A greenskin scurried up the ladder to the boss chair dais, a hunchbacked, wheezing creature clad in a greasy white smock, black leather glove gauntlets, and grimy goggles. He fumbled with a dirt-encrusted syringe as the warlord started to spasm violently, shaking the near-unconscious Slyboy back and forth like a rag doll. The bent-over pain boy, syringe finally readied, lunged forwards with a yelp and stabbed it into the meat of the warboss's thigh, using both hands to inject a huge load of viscous-looking yellow liquid. Urgork's head snapped back, He let out a shuddering gasp as both eyes refocused. His hand unclenched, and Slyboy clanged to the deck, choking and retching. Grok yanked the syringe out and backed away, twitching nervously. The war boss lowered his head again, slowly flexing his neck and shoulders. Bones crunched and popped. The savage seizure that had gripped him was gone. He nodded to Grok.
My thanks, Doc.
Slyboy had used the few seconds' respite to attempt to crawl away, feeling his way blindly through the detritus littering the command deck. Urgork grunted and snatched him by the scruff of the neck.
Tell me again, Sly, he growled. Tell me of division.
There's all down there, boss,
the pitiful orc mewled.
All the hard boys in their big ruined city.
And the one in white, too?
Yeah, boss, course.
And you got Big Mech Cog Crusher the proper coordinates, Urgork demanded.
Yeah, boss, I swears.
Urgork grunted again and released the weird boy.
Then it's time,
he said, yanking his second skinning blade from the squig corpse.
Grok, stand close, he barked.
When the hunched pain boy was crouched next to his boss's chair, he slammed the hilt of one of his blades into a huge red button that was wired crudely into the arm of the seat. Nothing happened. Urgork sighed and hit it again. There was a violent lurch and a scream of rusting gears as juddering motion seized the chair. It began to descend, disconnecting from the circular dais around it, sinking down into the deck with an unhealthy rattle. Urgork's grin returned as he was carried down, down from his flagship, through its refuse-clogged holds, and then on into Morcopolips. The great hollowed-out meteorite was packed full of the boys, its multiple decks resounding with the chanting of individual mobs and warbands as they worked themselves into a battle frenzy. The platform on which the boss chair sat passed each open level one by one. As it went by, Urgork bellowed and slammed his long knives together. Each passing deck roared back its approval, driven into a mania by the presence of their war boss. He watched as an orc knocked down another in one of the mobs, a fight breaking out instantly as individual boys vented their mounting battle frenzy in the only way they knew how. This was gonna be a right proper scrap when it all kicked off. Finally, the platform clattered to a stop, the crudely modified gravlift levered into the control room at the rock's heart. Stapskar and his chief knob, Grimtooth, were waiting for Urgork, in among Big Mech Cog Crusher and his tinkerers. Urgork gestured to the commando boss with one claw. Stapskar forced his way to the chair's side and bowed low, his soiled camo cape draping the mesh decking plates.
You and your boys know your job, Stabber,
the warlord demanded.
Course, boss. We won't let you down again.
Then let's go,
Urgork bellowed, slamming the pommels of both knives into the flanks of his chair.
What we waiting for? Orbital entry,
Cog Crusher said, after a moment's silence, the big mech's voice like the rattle of rusty gears. Urgork glowered.
Fine,
he grunted.
Won't be long now, boss,
Cog Crusher clattered, bionic optics clicking as they focused on the control room's plethora of cracked, mismatched viewscreens.
The Humi ships is coming for a scrap.
Polixis. The evening sky above Ikara 9 was riven by fire as new stars burst into brief, furious life overhead. Most of those on the planet's surface saw little but indistinct flares amidst the grey smog that blanketed the polluted atmosphere, but the wind that sometimes knifed down from the tombstones was blowing a gale as night fell, affording Polixis a view of the full fury of an orbital engagement playing out. He watched the silent flashes and flares light up the dark from the steps of the Basilica of St. Albarak, the smelter. Demeter and Castor were still inside. The feverish activity of the headquarters had entered overdrive, with an immediate planet-wide stand-to being issued. Orders coming out of Croton seemed to be rudderless, sometimes contradictory. Demeter had passed on word that Shipmaster Xerxes and Rear Admiral Corrin were going to engage the vanguard of the Xenos fleet before withdrawing, an act that Demeter had left to Xerxes's discretion. With nothing to contribute to the command and control of the developing situation, Polixis had taken his leave. The Basilica Square lay before him, quiet and wrapped in nighttime shadows. The broken remains of a Chimera armored personnel carrier sat where it had been gutted by an Orc rocket earlier in the day. Alien bodies had been heaped in one far corner and burned by flamer-armed purification teams, their stinking, charred remains now smouldering in the dark. Much of the rest of the square had been taken up by mortuary orderlies, who had laid out row after row of dead Imperial guardsmen, clad in the black plastic wraps of Munitorum-issue body bags. Bar a few off-duty troopers, smoking lows and talking quietly near the foot of the steps, and an ecclesiarchy preacher moving along the dead ranks, sprinkling blessed salve, the square was empty. Polixis briefly pondered the curious similarities between the dead below and Ovido's body lying in the crypt beneath him. The sheer scale of the Astra Militarum's losses made it tempting to think of their deaths as more impersonal, almost meaningless. But in truth, Polixis knew the difference between the fallen was more slender than it seemed. All had fallen in the cause of mankind. All had received a blessing over their remains. All would live on in the memories of their battle brothers. As far as Polixis was concerned, the sacrifice was one and the same. He turned his eyes once more to the distant, deadly beauty of the unfolding high-orbit engagement, his mind continuing to wander. The litanies he had memorized as an initiate spoke so often of the importance of legacy and heritage, of how, through his gene seed, an Adeptus Astartes could live forever. Once he had doubted such claims. No conscious memory remained. All else was mere metaphor. Future battle brothers learned the names of those who had gone before, and their many deeds, and perhaps their breasts swelled with pride, knowing they bore a part of them inside. But it was all so much history. But such doubts had only plagued Polixis when he had still been young, still grappling with his new existence. He knew better now. Individuality meant nothing.
The purpose of us all is to fight and to sacrifice ourselves when we can fight no more, Polixis murmured to himself as he watched the sky, letting the induction litany of the Apothecarian ease his thoughts. To pass on our own gene seed so that another can serve the chapter when we no longer can.
There was perhaps extra poignancy in the fact that Ovido had been Mars-born, among the first of his kind. A little over half of the Fulminata were the same. They had come to Ultramar, to McCrag, and painted their Mark 10 power armor the blue of the Ultramarines. They had learned the chapter's doctrines by rote, fought and bled and died beside their new brothers, but they had not been from Ultramar, nor even from the 500 worlds. They were the first of their kind, the first Primaris, forged on a distant red planet by a being far beyond the understanding of any of them. Polixis was not Mars-born. He was from the realm of Ultramar, a son of the Agri-world of Ajax, the first Primaris Ultramarine to be recruited from the worlds the Chapter called home. One of the first, he corrected himself, silently, as his blood brother came out onto the Basilica's steps to join him. Polixis nodded. Castor said nothing, looking to the sky. The occasional silent flash of a macro cannon broadside, or the blink beam of a lance strike reflected from the glossy black sheen of his power armor. Neither of them spoke. A memory intruded as Polixis watched his brother. He remembered looking up at the spread of stars, lying on his back, limbs aching from a long day's toil. The night air had been warm and quiet and full of the sweet musk of the harvest cycle. The medicate in him explained the sudden recollection easily enough. It was nothing more than the firing of brain synapses, a shadow in an abandoned room that vanished with the coming of light. Such flashes were not unheard of among the first generation of Primaris born within the realm of Ultramar. Polixis understood better than most that, for all their prowess as warriors, the creation of new Primaris was not a perfect process. Castor could sometimes summon up what appeared to be perfectly clear memories of their shared childhood. For Polixis, it was far harder. His past was relegated to these half-moments, so slender and so fine that they felt unreal. His training as an apothecary helped him rationalize them as a simple, minor failing in his induction process. Once, perhaps, he had reclined in the agri-fields of Ajax, maybe close to the collective that he called home, with his brother at his side, watching the night sky. It didn't matter. He told himself that whenever the shadow memories stirred. Those agri-fields were long gone now, and that starry sky had been ripped in half by the stuff of nightmares. "What news, brother?" he asked Castor, deliberately breaking the contemplative stillness.
"From orbit,"
Castor replied, eyes still on the starry vault.
"Xerxes has engaged. He is attempting to target the rock, but the Xenos have it well shielded. He will be forced to withdraw within the hour."
"And from High Command?"
"Von Klimt is demanding reinforcements for Croton. He expects that to be the rock's target. Kloss has agreed to send his reserve. 2 corps. They're mobilizing as we speak."
"This will be bloody," Polixis said, eyes on the guardsmen in the square below.
"It is a blessing," Castor replied, his voice low but tinged with relish.
When Polixis said nothing, he went on.
"The Xenos' supreme warlord will be among their fleet. He has come here to fight. Of that there can be no doubt. He presents us with an opportunity. Slay him, and his dominion over the green-skinned tribes he commands will end. They will fragment, as they always do, and this war will turn at a stroke. Kill Warlord Urgork, and the subsector will be cleansed before the year is out."
"You are fortunate, my little brother, to always be able to find a bloodthirsty positive among our dire circumstances. Were a whole company at our side, I may share your optimism. We have here only half strength, and we have suffered losses."
"The captain knows how to use what he has," Castor said, his voice full of certainty. "Once the Xenos leader commits himself, we shall strike."
"It is already decided, then?"
"It is. Word is being passed to Lieutenant Samson and Tyrannus. We are preparing to move with the dawn. Croton is presumably their target, so we will go there, too."
"Has the captain told Field Marshal Kloss?"
"He is doing so now. I doubt there will be many objections. The Field Marshal is brash, for a human. His ire is focused on his commanding general, and the fact that he is expected to send his reserves to support him."
"He will need them here, I imagine," Polixis said. "As soon as the warbands across the river realize their fleet has seized orbit, they will attempt a counterattack."
"It is only a shame that we will not still be here to greet them," Castor growled.
"You seemed eager to purge today, brother," he said, smiling knowingly.
Even now, after so long, seeing his younger brother roused to ire brought him a mixture of amusement and something akin to awe.
"The Xenos here are weak," Castor said, without any hint of levity, and Polixis could sense the fire that forever smoldered in his brother stirring once more. "Even by the oafish standards of their degenerate race, we can see why now. This was only a second front for them. Well, now it has become their primary focus. When the Xenos warlord comes, he will bring his best with him."
"A challenge, if nothing else," Polixis said heavily.
"As the Emperor wills."
Polixis nodded but said nothing more, as overhead a great flash lit up the sky, illuminating everything beneath for a few seconds, like the birth of a second sun. Somewhere high above, the apothecary knew an entire ship had just died. Xerxes. To a casual observer, The quiet that had reigned over the bridge of the Spear of Macragge had been totally subsumed. The multi-tiered command decks rang with the clatter of proximity alarms and incoming munitions warnings. The communications pits were filled with the hissing, crackling urgency of dozens of vox messages, and cogitators chimed and pinged with reports from weapons systems, the engineerium, the shield generators, and the astrocartography bay. Blue-uniformed runners and rating officers hurried from workstation to workstation, or up the flights of narrow spiral stairs to the upper tiers, polished boots ringing off the mesh rungs and decking plates. Xerxes reigned over it all from his command throne, like a graven colossus in the midst of a bustling town square, immovable, largely silent, his occasional commands issued in clear, measured tones. The bridge of a ship of war as large and as powerful as the Spear of Macragge was never a truly calm place during a full void engagement. The scenes unfolding around the shipmaster were a prime example of a well-drilled and highly dedicated command crew carrying out the tasks they had all performed many times previously. The engagement with the Xenos vanguard seemed to be going well, and the Ultramarine's warship was running at optimum efficiency. But it did not take all of Xerxes's experience to be able to see that unfolding events presaged disaster. His eyes narrowed as he watched the data displays, already anticipating the turning of the tide. The Imperial Navy Avenger-class Grand Cruiser Lance of Vengeance was out of position. It had taken up station starboard of the Spear of Macragge, and it had closed relentlessly with the oncoming vanguard of the Xenos fleet. Rear Admiral Corrin, in tandem with Xerxes, had changed the course of his flagship, the Pride of Makaroth, to engage the Orc escorts from range. Too close, and the trio of Imperial capital ships ran the risk of becoming entangled with the main Xenos fleet bearing down on them. And nor did Xerxes want to risk an Orc boarding action when his battle barge was bereft of its complement of Adeptus Astartes and had only half of its Thunderhawks and none of the Overlords on station. Keeping the Orcs at distance for as long as possible also slowed their arrival to the anchorage point above the city of Croton, the expected target of the alien flagship and its rock payload. "You've drifted," Xerxes said to himself. He didn't have a vox link established with the Lance of Vengeance's commander, and he already knew that transmitting anything now would be in vain. Without stasis anchor or a new heading, the Lance of Vengeance was turning on its port broadside, close to the Orc fleet. Xerxes knew that its captain, Marrow, had a record of high-risk manoeuvres and close encounters, a past that explained his position in charge of an aged, largely outdated grand cruiser like the Lance. Marrow had already complained that the short-range batteries of the Avenger would be completely wasted if unleashed from distance. Xerxes tapped into the vox traffic between Marrow and Admiral Corrin, expression grim as the scale of the approaching disaster became more apparent.
"I will have you before the Admiralty Board if you don't disengage immediately, Marrow," Corrin shouted.
Marrow's response was a sound of weak affirmation. Xerxes had heard that sort of noise enough times before during void combat, where a man's fate was sealed long minutes before death's slow reach caught up with him. He already knew it was too late. A trio of greenskin escorts, little more than brute conglomerations of welded-together scrap, were triggering their hyperthrust, burning out their oversized plasma drives in violent bursts of sudden speed. Xerxes could only watch the hollow chart, mapping out the movement of the ships around the Spear of Macragge, as the outmaneuvered Grand Cruisers struggled to turn, Marrow caught in panic between the desire to finish bringing his port batteries to bear and the sudden need to escape. Whichever he chose, his fate was sealed. A point-blank storm of fire from the Lance of Vengeance ripped apart one of the oncoming escorts, dwarfed by the Grand Cruiser's bulk, but the other two made it through. They rammed themselves directly into the Imperial ship's flank. The Spear of Macragge's prow-picked casters caught the collision, and Xerxes watched with a dark expression as the first alien warship slammed home. They had been built with just such insanely brutal tactics in mind. Both were wedges of reinforced detritus, created to shield the larger Orc ships from incoming fire, and when the time was right, plough indiscriminately into enemy vessels. Xerxes saw bulkheads and the Lancer's macro-cannon batteries buckling in slow motion, a ripple of tearing adamantium rupturing the hull and collapsing deck after deck. He knew he was watching the deaths of thousands. He had experienced the same numerous times during void combat, but the remoteness, the silence, and the almost languid slowness of the collapsing capital ship still rendered it all deeply disconcerting. Then the second orc escort hit, this time towards the Lancer's aft, and the grim spectacle reached a crescendo. The impact of the alien vessel against the reinforced plating beneath the Grand Cruiser's bridge tower deflected it, slamming it into the side of the Engenarium block. The plasma drives buckled, then detonated. The blast travelled in a wave of broiling blue flame along the length of the lance, consuming both it and the battered remains of its killers. As the sunburst flash of total annihilation lit the void, the spear of McCragg's auger systems overloaded, the picked feeds shorting out before blinking back online. The Lance of Vengeance was gone. All that remained was a scattering of debris, flickering with fires that died out in the vacuum of space.
"Gunner, maintain your rate of fire," Xerxes ordered, then switched to the communications pits. "Get me a link to the Pride of Makaroth."
"Shipmaster Xerxes,"
came Corrin's voice over the vox. He sounded strained.
"I believe the time to withdraw has come, Rear Admiral," Xerxes said.
When his words were met with silence, he carried on.
"We have already suffered a blow here for little gain. We must not compound Captain Marrow's mistake."
"You're correct,"
Corrin replied, though Xerxes could sense the rage that burned in every word, the desire to avenge the loss of the Lance of Vengeance by throwing the entirety of the battle fleet against the oncoming greenskins.
"I will issue orders for an immediate disengagement."
"The Spear of McCragg will hold station until you have set a course," Xerxes offered, knowing the Admiral's ponderous flagship would need some time to come about.
"My thanks, Ultramarine,"
Corrin responded. The link went dead.
"Shipmaster, the Xenos are changing formation,"
one of the auger attendants called up from the sensorium banks. Xerxes turned his gaze from the Pride of Makaroth's representation on the holochart back to the alien fleet. The auger analysis was correct. The sigils were shifting across the display. Until that moment, the alien fleet had remained clustered around its flagship, denying the Imperial long-range bombardment the opportunity to target the Warlord's vessel. Now, however, they were spreading away from it, their cumbersome drives adopting new headings that carried them wide across Ikara's orbit. For a moment, Xerxes thought they were trying to outflank and envelop the Imperial ships before they could pull away. Then the icons that represented the alien fleet blinked. Another had been added by the auger arrays, adjacent to Urgork's flagship, but pulling away rapidly. Xerxes realized what he was looking at. The flagship had released the rock. Moreover, it had done so early, long before it was positioned in an orbital arc above the capital city of Croton.
"Link to Captain Demeter immediately," he ordered the vox seneschal. "Signal to the surface. The sky is about to fall."
Polixis. Polixis saw it first as a twinkling amidst the fiery sky. It grew rapidly, a star burning white as it fell from the war-wracked firmament, a herald of annihilation. The vox network burst into frantic chatter, garbled orders, reports, and requests for clarification flooding the channels. All eyes in the Basilica Square stared heavenwards as the light grew to a furious intensity.
"May the Emperor and the Primarch be with us all,"
Castor murmured when he caught sight of the white blaze. The scream of the plummeting rock filled the air, a roar of bone-shuddering intensity vibrating through every brick and girder in Shabbat. Polixis could do nothing but watch as the light filled the sky, the whole world, its rage like the primordial awakening of a new god. It howled overhead, framed by the basilica's spires, eclipsing the city's ruinous skyline. The strength of its passing threw the guardsmen across the square down to the rubble-littered flagstones. It almost shook even the space marines from their feet. The rock struck. It hit south of the basilica, amongst the remains of the slums near the eastern bank of Gorgon. The impact sounded like the death knell of the whole world, coupled with a flash of light even more brilliant than the destruction of the capital ship in orbit above. Polixis saw the skyline of the city to the south, caught like a snap picked in a moment of perfect clarity, backlit by the fire of the collision. He braced himself. As the report of the meteorite's impact echoed through Shabbat, the shockwave struck. The buildings on the south side of the square, already reduced to bullet-scarred walls and mounds of rubble, crumbled. The blast slammed debris into the square, throwing up the corpses lying there alongside those still living. Both Castor and Polixis were picked up and flung, despite the efforts of their power armor servos and stabilizers, directly back into the wall of the basilica. Polixis grunted, his genhanced body stopping the blow from stunning him or driving the wind from his lungs, even as he felt a section of his armor's backpack unit crumple. He fell to his knees alongside Castor as the wave passed on, the sounds of the rock's impact still ringing in his skull, his lyman's ear failing to cancel out the thunderous noise. The Basilica of St. Albarac, the smelter, still stood. Its foundations had been laid deeper and stronger than any other building in Shabbat Alpha, and though its crypts quaked and stones were shaken from its belfry, the walls remained intact. Polixis regained his feet. The scene of destruction that would undoubtedly have played out before him was lost, completely obscured by the dust cloud that had accompanied the blast wave. Even with his auto-sensors stripping out the haze and boosting what little light there was, he could barely make out the bottom of the basilica's entrance steps. The Vox had also gone silent, the landlines to the main communications hub broken, the impact and the dust distorting the remote channels. For a moment, Polixis felt he and Castor were the only beings left on Ikara, perhaps the only two left in the whole of existence. There was nothing, nothing but the swirling of the dust and the low hiss of the Vox, a dreadful, languid peace left in the wake of the terrific destruction. It was the quiet of near total extinction.
"The rock,"
Castor said, jolting his brother from the surreal reverie he'd slipped into.
"How far to the south do you think it came down?"
"Within the city limits," Polixis said, starting to move down the steps.
"Where are you going?"
Castor demanded.
"I'm needed elsewhere,"
the apothecary replied, pausing and looking back up at him.
"See to the captain, brother. He will need you now more than ever."
"Go carefully," Castor warned. "The Xenos are upon us."
Polixis forced himself not to respond to the obviousness of his blood brother's instructions. He knew that he tried to advise Castor just as frequently. The difference between them was that the chaplain would, more than likely, snap something back at him, whereas Polixis usually managed to hold his tongue and accept the advice. Somehow, he knew this had always been the case. Polixis ran across the square. The auto-sensors, shared by the Primaris, were still online, still connected. His diagnoster was reading half a dozen injuries, all from squads along the southern edge of Shabbat. Scroll data indicated damage caused by collapsing buildings. Shadows loomed at him from out of the impenetrable dust, limping and stumbling. Anyone in the city not blessed with the genhancements of the Adeptus Astartes had undoubtedly been left stunned by the rock's landing, ears deafened and movements sluggish. The sky itself had come down, and death had followed. Polixis did not stop to assist them. There was worse coming. He knew that thousands of greenskins would be disgorging from the rock, flooding its crater and storming the flattened streets around it. What was worse, they had come down on the imperial side of the Gorgon, effectively outflanking the gains made by the guard and the Primaris the day before. With a single great blow, the greenskins had all but reclaimed Shabbat Alpha. The apothecary carried on into the rubble beyond what had once been the edge of the square. There were no more streets to follow, only an undulating wasteland of wreckage, spars and twisted girders jutting through mounds of broken masonry. The thousands of Hablocks, refineries and manufactoria south of the Basilica, reduced to complete ruination. The dust still hung heavy in the night air, so that he had only his armor's inbuilt compass and the blinking burst map to navigate by. It was slow, hard going. He came across more survivors as he went, mostly rear echelon guard units.
"Help us, my lord,"
one man pleaded, stumbling from the darkness, cradling a broken arm. Others bore injured comrades, crying out for the Space Marine's aid or for orders amidst the confusion. He stopped for none. He had no instructions for them, and no time to help them tend injured friends or dig others out from under the collapsed ruins. If he did pause, more would die when the orcs struck. After a while, his vox bead crackled back to life. Demeter had managed to re-establish the link to the rest of the demi-company, and his instructions went out to all squads, his voice as calm and level as ever.
"Field Marshal Kloss has ordered a complete withdrawal from Shabbat. We will be facilitating that retreat. The dust cloud from the rock is still too thick to risk a full aerial extraction, so it will be on foot. All squads are to hold their current positions for 30 minutes, so that the guard can conduct a staggered, overlapping move eastwards, towards the ash wastes. There, they will seek to establish a new front line. All units confirm."
Polixis Blink acknowledged the fresh orders as he went, even disregarding the fact that there were now thousands of greenskins on the eastern bank of the river. The devastation wreaked by the rock's impact had shattered Imperial command and control. Units were scattered, dazed and struggling to deal with thousands of casualties from the collapsed buildings. Some were cut off, others had simply vanished, buried by the sudden violent tremors that had shaken apart most of the city. From the reports trickling in on the other frequencies, it seemed as if the main combat forces stationed along the newly taken line of the Gorgon's east bank were largely intact, but spotters were reporting increased activity from across the polluted river, including what looked like crude barges and rafts. The Xenos on the western bank had clearly been preparing to cross en masse for some time, and now that reinforcements had arrived, they were seizing the opportunity. Combined with the assault expected from the rock itself, there was no practical means for the guard to resist for long, even with the Primaris at their side. Polixis paused to check his visor display beside a street lumen whose wrought iron post had somehow survived the demolition of everything around it. The nearest squad, Clastis, was a mile to the west, overlooking a stretch of the river docks. They weren't reporting any casualties. The second nearest, Squad Domitian, was. According to the Vox, brothers Ennio and Trejo had been buried by the roof of a collapsing manufactorum, and the rest of Domitian were still working to extract them. They were the most southern of the Primaris squads. When the greenskins from the rock first encountered Imperial forces, it would be Domitian's hellblasters.
"I am approaching from the northeast. Watch your targeting matrices," Polixis said over the vox.
A few minutes later, he discerned shapes in the gloom ahead, the familiar bulk of Mark 10 power armor.
"Well met, Brother Apothecary,"
Sergeant Domitian called out as he approached. Like everyone else, the Ultramarine's proud blue armor was now a uniform grey, caked in the dust that had shrouded Shabbat. Four of Domitian's hellblasters, Brothers Gratian, Junarius, Lorenz, and Luco, were standing watch over the rubble that had once been a manufactorum side row, while three more, Marius, Otho, and Victus, worked to haul debris away from one of the numerous mounds that had formed where one of the refinery city's workhouses had once stood.
"Ennio and Trejo were still inside when the shockwave hit," Domitian said, "as were Gratian and Luco, but they were able to work themselves free."
"You have contact with them both over the vox?" Polixis asked.
"Yes, I'll patch you through."
"Brother Apothecary,"
crackled Ennio's voice over the link. He sounded calm and unhurried, apparently untroubled by the fact that he was buried beneath tons of rubble.
"Can you describe your injuries to me, brother?" Polixis asked, assessing the remote Vitae readout as he spoke.
"Left arm shattered," Ennio said tersely. "It is unresponsive." both legs, Trejo added, the pain audible in his voice. You should leave me, brothers. I will only be an encumbrance.
Cease such foolish chatter, Polixis ordered, checking the rubble underfoot.
The armor of the two Primaris had clearly taken the worst of the collapse. Any unaugmented human would have been immediately crushed by the building's fall.
We shall have you up soon, brothers, he added.
We are to withdraw when they are recovered, Domitian said.
So it seems. The guard are retreating eastwards.
Domitian didn't answer. After a pause, Polixis realized why. His genhanced hearing, further magnified by his power armor, had detected noises in the darkness, out beyond the small perimeter established by the squad. Bestial bellows and roars, and the pounding of iron-shod boots.
Xenos, Domitian said. From the south,
Brother Gratian added, plasma incinerator raised.
We must hurry, Polixis said, unclamping his absolver bolt pistol.
Prime incinerators,
Domitian ordered, the words followed by a low whine and the blue glow of charged plasma, suffusing the dust-choked night.
Otho, Marius, and Victus had redoubled their efforts to drag aside the rubble, working down towards the locator tags triggered by Ennio and Trejo.
Are there no guard units nearby?
Polixis asked, as the raucous sound of the approaching mob grew louder.
None that survived,
Domitian said, facing south into the night.
We rescued about a dozen men, all injured. They're on their way to the rear.
There was a thudding burst of bolter fire, muffled and distorted by the dust. Polixis half turned, checking the designator on his display. The squads further along the Gorgon, including the nearest, Clastis, had begun to engage the greenskins that were attempting to cross the river. Any hope of support was rapidly evaporating.
Fire at will,
Domitian ordered. The bellowing from the darkness had reached fever pitch, seeming to resound from all quarters, filling the night with the chilling promise of bloodshed. Polixis felt his twin hearts rising to the tempo of the approaching battle, and realized a snarl of adrenaline-fueled anticipation was splitting his lips. In that moment, he understood once again where Castor's burning passion for the thunder of war came from. A shout went up from Victus. Polixis saw he was dragging battered, grime-encrusted plate armor from the rubble at his feet. The Tabrin campaign markings were visible around the gorget. It was Ennio. Polixis started towards him. At the same time, hunchback shapes came lumbering from the dust-swathed night, their roars filling the darkness.
Open fire!
Roared Domitian.